Welcome to episode 7 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse in which four friends slash Doctor Who fans attempt to rewatch seasons 1 to 3 before the season 4 premieres on Amazon in December. Before we start the discussion of episodes 3 and 4 of the second season, let's go around and introduce ourselves.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Chip Sutterth.
I'm Katie Burt.
And I'm Warren Fry.
Okay, so we're solidly into season 2 now. Things have escalated very quickly. What were our general impressions of these two episodes?
There's less going on in the first two, but there's still plenty going on.
Yeah. I also think ramming spaceships into things was like a way to solve a lot of problems. Is this a common thing they do?
Oh, man. Like, let's get you watching Babylon 5 sometime.
Is that a record? Let's note how long into the podcast it took for Chip to mention Babylon 5.
Hey, it's not as bad as the pool that's out there for how many times we'll use the word expansive talking about this show.
Is there an actual pool out there, or are you the pool?
If I say we have a pool, then that implies that we have billions of listeners. So, yes, okay. We've got a pool.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Social media cannot stop buzzing about it.
Nah. Hey, listen, how about cliffhangers? Both of these episodes.
Great cliffhangers.
I know, which is sad when you're trying to, you know, keep it to two episodes a week for podcast purposes. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's getting harder to stop the episodes. I know I could watch them ahead of time, but that's not really how I roll.
And especially since Amazon is super impatient, they'll be like, starting in 10 seconds. Oh, no, just kidding. Here it goes.
They give you no time.
No, none.
I actually really would like to do write an article or maybe just start a Twitter discussion about like the various streaming platforms and how long they do or don't give you. I just feel like these personalities amongst like streaming platforms are forming, especially as like all these other subscription services are about to launch. I'm getting off topic now, although relevant because The Expanse now lives on Amazon.
That's true. It does. Mm-hmm. I'm eager to talk about these shows. Can we talk about these shows?
Yes.
Can we synopsize?
Yes,
let's do it. Chip, why don't you tell us about the first episode, Static?
Static aired on February 8th, 2017. Everyone is reeling from the Battle of Thoth Station. Holden's mad at Miller for shooting mad scientist Dresden. Naomi's mad at Holden for being mad at Miller. Alex is mad at himself for not being able to stop 25 belters from mad dying in the space battle. It's a mad episode. Naomi takes out her frustrations by blowing off some steam, belter style, with Drummer. This means an intense game of handball, followed by some dance therapy at the club. And meanwhile, Amos and Holden attempt to get information about the protomolecule out of Cortazar, the surviving sociopathic nanoinformatics specialist that they found on Thoth Station. Holden sucks at interrogation. Amos does not. He gets Cortazar to tell them about his fascination with the protomolecule and the fact that it's building something. Meanwhile, Miller goes undercover as a prospective passenger on the Nauvoo, the generation ship the Mormons plan on taking on their long journey beyond the Sol system to Tau Ceti. Not if Miller has anything to say about it. He has an idea. Use the Nauvoo as a battering ram to knock Eros Station and the protomolecule that inhabits it into the sun. Meanwhile, in the MCRN Marines, Bobby's squad is frustrated that they won't be retaliating for Earth's destruction of the Martian moon Deimos. They take it out on each other, most especially by picking on Earther-turned-Martian Travis. It devolves into fisticuffs before they manage to patch things up. They're all too Team Mars to stay mad at each other for long. And finally, on Earth, Christian reaches out to Fred Johnson, treason, and forms a tentative alliance, also treason. Watch out, Aaron Wright and Jules-Pierre Mao. Christian and Fred Johnson are coming for you.
And next we have Godspeed, which aired February 15th, 2017. The Christian-Johnson alliance bears fruit quickly. Using intel from Johnson, Christian discovers a stealth ship with a bunch of dead former Protégé employees. Christian gets the ship into the news cycle. Mao just plays this off and says, how could he possibly know what happens in every corner of his vast, totally benevolent corporate empire? Meanwhile, Miller and Johnson get Naomi and Holden on board with their plan to knock Eros into the sun. They need to place a ton of explosives to cook the surface of Eros. Their explosive team is led by Joe, I've never been on a spacewalk, Miller. He's joined by everyone's favorite sidekick, Diogo. Now, while it's setting the explosives, a Doctor Without Borders in Space team is found trying to help those that are on Eros. They try to escape after being potentially contaminated by the proto-molecule, so Holden has to shoot them down. This leads to some debris, which breaks the ship on Diogo's bomb, and Miller stays behind to save the day. But as he's staring down the Naboo and it's his own demise, Eros changes course.
So these first two, or these two episodes, start with everyone kind of reacting to the episode two, the previous week's episode, when Miller shoots Dresden, even after he's basically been captured, and they have a chance to get information out of him about the protomolecule. And a lot of the beginning of this first episode is devoted to how people are reacting to that, which is interesting because there's a lot of plot points that this show just like breezes by, and you don't necessarily check in with the characters about how they're feeling. But what do we learn about all these different characters based on how they react to that decision that Miller makes to kill Dresden?
It's typical Holden, for sure. Like, going off in a righteous fury and not actually realizing why he did it.
Yeah. I think I wrote down in my notes, why is Holden so mad at Miller? He assumes Miller's motivations and doesn't take time to really think through any of his other possible motivations and just yells. Just so much yelling in these two episodes.
Yeah, he starts at like 11. Everyone else is kind of just like exhausted from this mission, this battle, and Holden is still like at 11. And it is interesting to see him respond so intensely to this, and it doesn't feel out of character, but in relation to the choice that he makes later to shoot down the like basically humanitarian ship that may be infected by the protomolecule, that in many ways is similar to where, you know, the Rossi team was at one point, wanting to share information with the rest of the solar system that, you know, they have a right to hear. But now he's in a position to be the one to make the judgment on whether that is the right course or not and to stop it by killing them.
Yeah, and his emotionality just sort of always seems to ramp up when he's... It's almost like he's overcompensating or he's in denial. I think there's a part of him that knows that what Miller did wasn't exactly lawful good, but it was understandable and there was some justification for it. You know, vigilante justice is not a good thing, but this is a guy who killed 100,000 people and could have shared the bad stuff with the whole rest of the system, as Miller explains later. So when Holden makes the same decision, destroying the Doctor's ship because of the threat that it poses to whoever else they might run into, you know, he blows it up and then he screams and goddamn it, he's near tears and all this other stuff. He's really resisting what he knows he has to do or he knows is justifiable.
And I do love the conversation he has with Naomi, where she does, you know, at first it doesn't seem like she's actually going to offer up her opinion, but then Holden kind of forces the point, which is understandable. I think if I felt so strongly about something, I would want to know what the people who I'm closest with feel about it as well. And she just makes all these points, like the one you made where, you know, he's like, he killed a man, and she's like, he killed a mass murderer. And she's not... I don't know, the way that the very different ways they react are really interesting to me. And I love that conversation they have.
I just like that we have Holden reacting so strongly to what Miller did. And then the very next episode, it's his turn, you know, it's his turn to make the tough call.
I honestly had to look up if those guys were Doctors Without Borders. I'm like, are they doctors? Oh, they more or less are. Okay, because it just seems so out of left field.
Yeah. I was also like, they sound like they might be like Swiss or something.
Or French. I thought they were French.
Yeah. Well, I was, my headcanon is like the French speaking part of Switzerland. Like, or like, you know, they're like, we're neutral. We're just out, you know, helping people, which is obviously its own complicated.
It's Medicine Sans Frontières, right? So it's like, I think it originated in France. I might be wrong about it. So, which I was like, well, that's a little too on point that they're all French. Okay, fine.
Yeah. Do we hear any other French accents in the show? I don't know.
Which presumably means they're either from the Belter version of New Orleans or they're from Earth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it's interesting how Alex reacts to everything that's going on in these episodes. He doesn't strike me as self-righteous as Holden, but he is still he's still got a serious overactive responsibility gland going on after the destruction of the breaching pod, and he's had time to sit with that, and he's going through Duolingo, only it's not language, it's battle simulations, you know, over and
I want
to
do a Duolingo battle simulator now.
I'm already afraid of that owl. I feel like if battle simulations were added to the equation.
Good point. You poke your eyes out.
Yeah. I would have nightmares.
A very judgy owl. Well, it's also just like, I think it also shows in some ways how isolated in some ways Alex is from the rest of the crew. Like, when Holden just like pokes his head up and it's kind of like, oh man, how long have you been up here? You get the sense that you know everyone else has been doing all these things and working through this, and he has just been sitting there for who knows how long.
Yeah, which makes me wonder how much of the like domestic emotional labor stuff he's doing, because we have seen, and this is very much like, you know, me adding a lens or whatever onto the show, it's not there, but we have seen him be the person who's like, we're having lasagna, we're having family dinner, everyone's showing up, okay? So I imagine if it were another character beating themselves up in the same way, Alex would eventually be like, hey, what's up, buddy? But because he's the one who's, you know, kind of losing it in this moment, it doesn't seem like any of the other Rossi crew members are really filling that role.
I mean, he kind of talks to Amos sometimes, but Amos is like, you know, either leaves him at the bar with some random woman or, you know.
True, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to be fair, they are all going through their own stuff. So they're all kind of off on their own. Aside from Amos and Holden, who kind of are in the same area of this narrative and on Tycho Station because they're both actively involved in the interrogation of this surviving scientist. What did we think about that storyline, you know, seeing Amos's interrogation technique versus Holden's interrogation technique and just learning a little bit more about the protomolecule in general?
It's kind of neat how you have this character who's totally without empathy. There's something off about him, and he can do anything that's necessary, and he goes in to interrogate this guy who had it happen to him magnetically. I mean, Amos and Cortazar are two sides of the same coin. The episode makes it really, really plain. And I don't know, in this whole episode, culminating with the interrogation stuff, Amos feels like the one stable center of the entire thing.
Oh, he totally does.
Yeah.
Although I had the exact same reaction as Holden, where he's like, when a pedophile, I'm like, where is this going? And so I kind of emphasized with Holden going, what's this discussion going to be? but it was interesting that he was the guy who could actually sit down and talk to this lunatic. And like all well-written lunatics, you're like, tell me more, you crazy person.
He's also the guy who is the one who's like tasked with talking to Miller, who he also, you know, when he brings him his stuff, all of his stuff. And he compares himself with Miller, which Miller seems to be like, what? but it is interesting thinking about that dynamic after, you know, also making the comparison between Amos and Cortazar, which is a ridiculous name.
I love Amos in this episode just in so much. He doesn't have quite so much to do in Godspeed, but just so magnetic. He is so magnetic and so wrong at the same time.
I love the moment when they're describing how the, like, you know, the magnets made these people psychopaths, which doesn't make any sense to me. But
no.
but I do love that one of Amos's first responses is to just be like, can it be reversed? Like, he's just like, and you don't know how much of that is in concern for this guy and how much is like him thinking maybe about himself.
Right. And would he welcome that, or would it scare him?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I remember the first time I watched this, I was like, what is Amos going to do? I thought there was going to be some more like him breaking out magnets or something to like try to do. I was like, what?
The magnet subplot.
Yeah. Like,
well, and when you ask like, would he welcome it? I think he would, in the sense that he's always looking for like an external sense of empathy in the form of another person. So it does seem like it's something he values on some level. And he obviously has a self-awareness that Cortazar doesn't. I do love as well that Amos explains to Holden how this interrogation technique will work. And then Holden's just so bad at it. Like, he's supposed to be, you know, we see Amos do it really well, where he just is able to, like, step into this role of being excited about the protomolecule and not at all horrified of like what it's done to humans and what's been done to humans in the name of this experiment. And Holden's just unable to remove the like horror and judgment from his interrogation technique. And I find that very endearing.
Makes him a bad interrogator, but a good human being. So it's not that we didn't yeah. already know that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I keep wanting to make alignment charts, Dungeons & Dragons alignment charts for all these characters at this point. And Holden is lawful good emotional.
Yes.
Yeah, but then he had to murder 25 doctors who were just trying to help out. So, I mean, where's that put him?
I know.
Which reminded me... that
lawful good emotional emo? I don't know.
Sure.
I'll accept it. There were a lot of moments in these episodes where I was like, this is the equivalent moment in Battlestar Galactica, which happens a fair amount when I watch all shows, but especially this show, which is very much, this is very much its own show. But the moment where Holden decides to shoot that ship reminded me so much of the moment early on in Battlestar Galactica when Apollo shoots down the ship and he doesn't know if there's passengers on it or not, but he has to make that decision. I don't even remember what the stakes were. But,
and that's
yeah.
like, yeah. what, 3 years after 9/11? So, I mean, that was yeah. probably much more resonant back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Battlestar Galactica, this show, and I've been thinking about this a lot all week, really scratches the Battlestar Galactica itch. Whatever it was that show had, yeah. this show definitely also has. They're not the same show, you're right, but they definitely do sort of zero in on that part of my brain. And it's why I have the complete series, new series, sitting on my Amazon wish list, waiting for the next paycheck.
We get some Eros dubstep in this episode. What do you guys think? Good music or bad music?
I mean, it was music they bought. Like, that's what it was. It wasn't good nor bad. I've done enough editing in my time that I'm like, oh, yeah, that's library music. But having said that, the weird part for me was watching a drummer being happy, because that's very rare from what I could tell.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of my favorite moments in this thing, and I remember feeling that way the first time I saw this. Just athletics and dance and partying and things like that. That Naomi's at home for mm-hmm. the first time. It feels like in ages.
Now, this is not a question I thought I'd be asking, but am I wrong to be shipping those two?
It sure
seemed afterwards when he asked how her night was that there was some room for interpretation as to what was going on there.
Oh, yeah. I'm totally, yeah. I mean, I love Naomi and Holden together, but I also am a fan of the idea of drummer and Naomi together.
Tumblr's on it.
Yes.
Well, surprise, surprise.
I mean. I may follow their ship tag name on Tumblr. Draomi, which is a terrible ship name. Someone should have come up with something better.
It's not as bad as Hufaldi. That's the absolute worst ship name.
That is terrible.
I'm not against the ship itself, but the name is terrible.
When they were playing handball, it did really remind me of this moment in Star Trek The Next Generation when Dr. Crusher and Counselor Troi have like a jazzercise class.
That happened several times.
Wow.
Well, in my brain, yes.
I had forgotten.
It's very
that.
Different, but I think this is like the modern day equivalent of that to a certain extent. And I am here for both of those scenarios.
Yeah. Well, it's like, yeah. How do women exercise? They must just do. I mean, that's also the 80s. It's like they were basically doing like TNG Jane Fonda. That's what I got out of those scenes. And now.
That's it. Very dated. Oh, and just before I forget, in the second episode, there's a very dated reference in The Expanse when Diego, everybody's favorite, says these are some great bangers coming from Eros. And I was like, bangers, I think, I'm not anyway a current person myself, but I think that's out of date now, or it's getting close to being out of date.
Maybe it comes back, Warren.
It's a minute 14, but by the time the 22nd century rolls around, I'm like, really? Seriously?
Anyway, yeah, sorry. They get nostalgic about that slang, and they bring it back.
I guess.
Yeah.
So, a very major decision is made in these episodes to commandeer the Naboo and use it for this harebrained scheme. And we do get to see a little bit of the Mormons' reaction to that, but for a move that is so... affects the Mormons a lot. We actually don't really get to see how it affects them, I guess. And
we just turf their country, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a question I should have asked in the spoiler section and we can continue to discuss, but I do think that this was something I thought we were going to see more of the repercussions for in that specific way when I first watched this episode. And even in this moment, in this one episode or in these two episodes, I wanted to see a little bit more of their perspective because I was really sad for them personally, even while I thought this was a great idea.
I find the Mormons super fascinating in this because they're just so different than everybody else. They just got such a different outlook than your average, you know, dirtbag I can't remember where Miller's from.
Siri,
yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
He's like everybody there seems to be a bit rough and tumble, and the Mormons aren't that. But they also can thrive there. So I just find them super interesting.
Right. Well, the Mormons that you're seeing in this story are self-selected, the ones that are going on this generation voyage.
Yeah.
So they're probably going to have fairly similar, you know, psychological types or whatever. And then Fred Johnson takes it all away from them, and he's talking about in scenes with Drummer, he's talking about basically this ruining him or this being the end of his career or whatever. And you know, it basically, the story does basically relegate the Mormons to those poor religious chumps.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of sidelines them. Now I don't know where I would have added what I would have taken away from this episode to put in the plight of the Mormons whose generation ship has been stolen from them. I'm not sure where I would have slotted that in. You know, there's a lot of plot going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do wonder what it would have looked like if they, you know, didn't give them a choice because the stakes are obviously very high here. But what if they had tried to explain to at least that, you know, Mormon leader character what is happening?
The sort of the easy script writing answer would have been he would have been very solemn and said, do what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the world of The Expanse.
Yeah.
No.
The world of The Expanse.
Honestly, I would say it's probably not the world of Mormons either. like if you're a powerful enough force, you know, money-wise or whatever else, to be able to build that thing in the first place, like, that's a very impressive feat of engineering. Why would you take this lying down? You would at the very least send a phalanx of lawyers out there.
Yeah. But the you know, they're just caught up in the churn, and that's they get discarded.
Yeah.
These episodes saw the return of Diogo, everyone's favorite character, has already been mentioned.
Although it was great to have Miller stuck in his room, room with him, and just being like so annoyed the entire time.
Yeah.
And you know, I was saying his room is not great, but it's not terrible. Like, he essentially has a dorm room, which compared to some of like the living conditions on like Eros or Sirius, it's like, you know, his decorating sense is terrible, but like,
oh yeah,
what he's been given is very nice.
His decorating sense is like 1978 14-year-old.
Yes.
Diogo knows who Diogo is, and Diogo is just leaning into it.
He is a teenage boy, basically. Oh, yeah. You know that room must just be a stench-filled hellhole.
But at the risk, you know, at the risk of damaging my brand a little bit, while I would never like the character of Diogo in so-called real life, he's actually fun to watch in this episode and in the following. You know, the character is doing more stuff. And he's in a different context and it shows off Andrew Rutilio's acting skills. He's got more to work with this time around. So I could deal with it.
I think he's more fun to watch this time around. Because you know what you're getting. The last time I was like, okay, enough of this guy, please.
I also think, you know, having him contrasted with Miller, like having never been on a spacewalk before, and Diogo's just kind of like, yeah, I've been doing this with my uncle since, like, you know, I was a kid, basically. You know, he has, like, skills. He's not just all, like, quips. And so I think that helps his character a lot in this episode.
And he does have Miller's back, you know, when Miller immediately loses his, what are they, like,
oh, he drops one of his explosives. And yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, I brought an extra one.
Diego's like, oh, yeah, don't worry about it, buddy.
And then and then when Miller gets a rip in a suit, he's like, just remember it's in his pocket.
Yeah, but he doesn't have Miller's back to the extent that he argues for a second when they have the issue with the bomb.
No.
Yeah, he's like, okay, bye.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is very in character. So moving to another of the many settings on The Expanse, we do get some good Christian storyline in these episodes. We get to see her continuing to toe the line, I guess, of her con, you know, that she is totally understanding of Aaron Wright and Jewel Pierre Mao, and she's on their side, and she has no idea that they would ever do anything nefarious. So the question is, would we ever want to play poker with Christian?
I don't want to ever against her in any context.
I want her on my side. Yes. Or not at all.
I like how she's sort of alternating between setting up the, you know, she orchestrated the destruction of Deimos. Because, as she said herself in the previous episodes, that was the smallest inevitable retaliation that Earth would conduct against Mars. But when she's in the room with Aaron Wright and Jean-Pierre Mao, she knows they're working together. But she is using the information that has fallen out of the sky for her to poke at him. She's at both of them, trying to pin them down, and it's just really, really skillful and really dangerous.
Yeah, and it is dangerous because Jean-Pierre Mao figures it out. Like, he's automatically, you know, says to Aaron Wright, she knows what's going on. And Aaron Wright still just thinks that they're totally pulling one over and everything's in control. But yeah, it does show how risky this is because he's someone who has a lot of power.
I love that line that Jean-Pierre Mao throws in at Aaron Wright about him being surrounded by mediocre bureaucrats and just has an inflated sense of self of his own security there. That's a fun working relationship to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also just it's really cool to see how patient Christian is as a character and how willing she is to let go of that ego for a while, at least, in relation to Aaron Wright, who's unable to accept that anyone might be smarter than him. Christian's just like, I'll play the fool for as long as it takes if the end result is the one I want. And it's really, it's like a form of like competency porn TV to watch her do her thing because she's so good at it.
Compare her skill under this pressure to Holden. I mean, it's night and day.
Or Aaron Wright, for that matter.
Yeah. It's actually, I mean, I know this is like, in some ways, you know, they seem to be in some sort of post-racial society, but us watching it kind of as contemporary viewers, it's like, of course this woman of color has figured out how to sit back and let people make judgments about her and get what she wants. It's very satisfying.
Yeah, and she is mostly surrounded by men.
Yeah.
There's a fair amount of, you know, other kinds of diversity in some ways. But yeah, she definitely plays her role well.
Yeah. She's just a joy to watch, that actress just like deliver those lines.
Were you guys surprised to see the alliance between Fred Johnson and Christian actually work out? Because there's so much about, you know, there's so many reasons why they could choose not to trust one another.
But they're also kind of similar people in that they're kind of people underestimate them. And they've managed to get on top of this pit of snakes, you know, and thrive.
They're both people who seem willing to sacrifice their own egos for the good of humanity, really. Like, they have their own political alliances, obviously. Fred Johnson, you know, is for the belt and the OPA, and Christian is for Earth. But in this circumstance, those align.
Mm-hmm. I guess I just mean they're not like Mao and Ehrenreich, who just seem so, you know, well, yeah, of course we're in charge. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. It does help that Christian got some sort of confirmation about the content of Fred Johnson's character from Souther in the previous episode. So knowing that he didn't knowingly kill all of those belters after they had surrendered, knowing that he's got a bit more of a moral core to him, you know, that helps facilitate in the story Christian reaching out to him. It moves pretty quickly and it moves pretty well. And, you know, we've seen in these episodes so far that Fred Johnson is he's one of the more stand-up righteous characters in the show. He's at least got a mature philosophy of leadership or whatever. He's certainly more mature in his leadership than Holden is. You know, he seems like a trustworthy stand-up kind of guy at this point.
Yeah, and, you know, you kept saying mature in that description, and it made me think about how many older characters there are, you know, of various ages in this world and show in a way that I think is relatively rare in television and movies.
That's true, yeah.
And the fact that because of that, you know, we saw Fred Johnson maybe make some choices earlier on that he isn't proud of, even having, you know, not having had that information about Anderson Station having surrendered. But yeah, we get to see what can come with aging. And obviously there's older characters who make very different decisions or who maybe haven't learned from their mistakes, but it's cool just to see that kind of representation.
But they also represent younger people fairly well too, like when you got the crew of Martians and even the Rossinati crew, except for Miller. There seems to be an actual conscious decision to have different generational views on stuff, whereas a lot of TV shows you don't get that. Everybody's just kind of written like some 35 to 40 year old probably male writer wrote them.
Yeah, and like where does Diogo fall in that as well, because he's a lot younger than, like, you know, the members of the Rossi crew.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously affects his character, and it's something that Miller alludes to, you know, when he's like, you'll figure it out. You know, I can tell you what you think or should, what I think or what I think you should think or what I think you will think even. But it doesn't matter. You have to live your life and hopefully, you know, figure some of this stuff out.
And that's another thing I like about Miller is that he seems like that guy who's like not trying to hang with the young people, but just kind of ends up hanging with the young people and doesn't fit in at all.
He gets a haircut.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in season one, he was Star Helix. He was sort of posing. He was really trying to reject his heritage or reject who he was. It took rooming with Diogo to help him come home. I mean, it kind of wow. Seems like that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful
I
want to
see a
moment.
Sitcom with those two now.
Oh, wow. We really turned a corner. Yeah. I actually love the cut between Miller getting a haircut and the drummer and Naomi at the club, because I think, Katie, you pointed this out when we're watching it. It's just a ton of belter haircuts. So you see him getting this belter haircut, and then it's like a ton of these people on the station already have this haircut because they don't have the same either they just want to fit in or they don't have the same kind of concerns that Miller has had about where his alliances lie.
And it's a nice point also of helping the Belters as a faction and as a people start to be defined in this show as their own selves, as opposed mm-hmm. to being defined in relationship to how Earth and Mars beat them down. Mm-hmm. You know, they feel like their own culture in and of themselves in their own right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And speaking of, you know, different cultures, we also get to check in with the Martian Marines a bit in these episodes. In what to me feels like the weakest plot, we get to see Bobby and her squad kind of work through some of their internal, you know, power struggles. What did you all think of this plot? Did you get a lot out of it? Did you think it was a valuable use of narrative time?
Yes and no, because I don't think it is for this episode, but also whenever you see stuff like this, it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. You're like, oh, they're building up to something and reminding us these people exist, because otherwise if they throw them in at the tail end of the season or whatever, you're like, well, these guys, where the hell did they come from? So this is just kind of placeholders, but placeholders for a reason.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me it would have worked a little bit better if we saw a little bit more of how the squad got from being, like, literally punching one another to just being like, oh, you guys, we're fine. And I, like, maybe there was a cut scene. That's kind of what it felt like to me. Or maybe it was never there and they were just like, this is how much time we have for this. And, you know, in some ways, this part of the show feels like, I always love the Christian stuff, but I know that, like, in some ways, the Earth stuff in season one can feel really, like, disconnected from the rest of what's going on. And maybe, like, you know, we're checking in for the sake of checking in. And for me, that's what this plot line felt yeah. like. Mm-hmm. Even while thinking that there probably is value, like you said, Warren, in checking in.
I also think it's like, in some ways, they're like making up with, what's his name? Travis. Mm. Feels a little bit like they just all kind of like pat each other on the back. But I think that's sometimes how these things have like, they're all saying terrible xenophobic things to him. And then they never really are like, oh, we actually think, you know, it's just like, we got to move on. Whether we've had a change of heart or not, they're not having like an in-depth discussion about the racial politics of Mars. They're just like, well, I think that's how sometimes those things happen.
And it yeah. tells us something about Martian marine culture.
Yeah. Of like, all right, yeah, we're just going to all fit into the team. And that's what's important.
Yeah. The stuff that you said, Katie, about the season one stuff with Earth and Christian and how connected or disconnected it felt, it at least contributed to the world building. But right now, we are just getting slice of life stuff from the Marines that are really on the periphery of everything else that's going on. And we can only speculate, because, of course, we're watching these episodes for the first time, whether we're spending so much time with these characters for a reason or not.
Mm.
When I was watching this for the first time, the only thing that sort of kept me at bay from being frustrated with how much time we were spending on these separate characters was having been spoiled elsewhere that this is a character that we were seeing early.
Yeah, I think actually watching this is a storyline that doesn't benefit in some ways from me knowing what happens next. We can discuss that more in the
maybe we should start to
yes, I think this is a good time to move on to our spoiler zone. For those who haven't watched past episode 4 of season 2 and do not wish to be spoiled for the rest of the season and for season 3, now is the time to shut off the podcast. I hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of Season 2's Home and Paradigm Shift. You can subscribe wherever good podcasts are found and follow us at Legit Salvage on Twitter. For everyone else, let's dive in. So do we want to pick that discussion back up? Because I think the point I wanted to make was that knowing that so many of Bobby's squad or her entire squad yep. was going to be killed so quickly made me less mm-hmm. interested this time watching it than I think I was the first time watching it, because I wanted to learn more about these characters and about this dynamic. Because in that, you know, as we've discussed, that's something The Expanse does well, because they felt like they might be around for a while.
Which is just a redo of what they did with the characters on the Canterbury in mm-hmm. the first couple of episodes.
Oh, true, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe as we get into season four and as we're introduced to batches of new characters, we should keep in mind that don't get too attached. I don't know.
Oh, especially when they come in groups, I think, is what we're learning.
Or maybe we should get attached, because in this case, it made watching the episodes better for me.
The first time.
Yeah.
Always get too attached, Chip. Always get too attached.
So I'm attached to Bobby. I love the character. And I love who she becomes. And we get good slices of her up to this point of the actress's chops, the character's fire and inner conflict and sort of inner anger, but also hope for the future of Mars. You know, she's a true believer. So ultimately, I like that we are getting this time with her early on, because it does pay off down the road. But it is kind of a bit of a slog getting through those bits, knowing that they don't have any real meaning other than this is what ultimately gets Bobby on Earth.
Well, it's very much her, like, origin story, backstory of, like, this is who she was before she goes through this, like, having her squad killed and then the entire politics around what that means and being asked to, like, give these testimonies. And, yeah, her shift in how she feels about Mars and the Marines and all of that. It is really interesting to see how much she's just 110% into this here.
Call me crazy. Is this the opposite of Julie Mao, where we got to see none of her? And instead we're getting to see all of Bobby before she becomes part of the main plots of the show?
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, it's not a similar situation at all, but if we're looking at other characters who are, you know, given more to do and earlier than in the books, like Christian's the same way, how would we feel about Christian? You know, I think it's less effective in the sense that those early episodes, she comes off like such an antagonist when you first meet her, like we've discussed. And she doesn't actually change that much as a character, which is super interesting to think about, because I think a lot of the characters on this show do. And maybe also is something to, you know, that relates back to our discussion of what it means to be an older character on this show or an older person in real life, maybe. But Bobby and Christian, we learned so much more about them. And also in relation to each other, just getting to see Bobby here and knowing that she's eventually going to choose to protect Christian when all she cares about here is retaliating against Earth and basically like killing as many Earthers as possible, it seems like. You know, a conversation she has with another older character, I believe his name is Sutton, who's
not
much
Button.
Not Button, as I not originally Button. Thought. He'll always be Button in my heart. But
it sounds like a Neil Gaiman story.
It does. we get to see those discussions they have. That's, you know, I've been rambling a lot here.
No, but you know, you're right. That is the payoff. All this time that we're spending with her, it's not just her intersection with the cast, but these opening four episodes with her really fired up against Earth set up her seeking asylum on Earth.
Yeah.
And how much that hurts her to do it.
It also gives you somebody to go, okay, I understand why Earth are a bunch of jerks. Because Earth are a bunch of jerks in a lot of ways, or at least at least the politicians are, if not the military. The military seem to be a little more reasonable, actually, but you at least get a different perspective on Earth other than the one we're going to naturally take being from Earth, right? So,
Yeah, and we do get a mention of Ganymede here at the very end of the storyline, the Bobby storyline we see in these episodes. She gets news that they're being sent to this like farm colony station, and she's totally bummed because she's just like, nothing's going to happen there. There's no action. And it's just another one of those moments that is takes on heavy dramatic irony when you're watching this for a second time, or, you know, a third or fourth time, whatever. Yeah, it is heartbreaking to watch a little bit. So another moment that we have in these two episodes that's like that a bit is we have this conversation between Miller and Naomi, which is really beautiful in lots of different ways. And we've discussed before how it's always interesting to see these two Belter characters who have kind of, you know, moved into a more like mixed cultural situation, have discussions and, you know, speak Belter to one another. But here we see Miller telling Naomi that sample, the one that they left, that's on you. You do the right thing with it. And it's interesting to see that conversation and the fact that he is someone who's like giving ownership to Naomi specifically, which is not necessarily something he is even, you know, has the power to do. But that how that affects maybe her decision later on to share that with Fred Johnson.
Hmm. I keep thinking she's already done it. I don't know why in my head it's always like, oh, she hasn't given it to him yet? Oh, not this episode either? Like, I just keep thinking he's got it for some reason.
I know. I think because in some ways they really moved to be closely aligned with Fred Johnson so quickly. And like her kind of distrust of him as an OPA kind of figure kind of falls away as like an active part of the story. That you're like, oh, she must have just, like, shared everything. But she really keeps that. They all keep it in their back pocket. But especially her, considering where she ends up going with that.
Yeah, so many plot lines on the show move so quickly that in rewatching it, that surprises me. So when a plot line is a lot slower and more measured, it does feel like, wait, no, everything else is moving a lot faster than I remember. So why is this not, why hasn't this already, you know, come to fruition? And I think that the protomolecule sample is definitely one of those things for me as well.
She gives the protomolecule sample to Fred Johnson after he has taken advantage of the moment that he doesn't need to fire those 30 nuclear missiles at Eros anymore. Mm-hmm. And he hangs on to them, making a compelling case for having them as a balance of power. When that happens, unless I'm misremembering season two, I think that puts the thought in Naomi's head that that's where the protomolecule needs to be as well.
And it's the moment where she, because doesn't, I think it's also after she realizes Earth has the protomolecule and Mars has the protomolecule. So it is her giving, at this point, she doesn't know really who has the protomolecule. And
there's still an idea that it could be completely destroyed.
Yeah, other than that sample. So she's kind of like, well, no one should have it. But then it's like, oh, she's going to continue to balance that power, like you said, Chip, and give it to Fred Johnson and essentially make the belt somewhat equal.
And these are the first episodes where we've gotten hints before of the protomolecule having more power than previously thought, or having more intelligence, I guess, than previously thought. And the moment where it stops the Naboo is such a chilling and important moment in this story. If you can think back to when you first watched this episode, did you realize how significant that moment would be? Did it feel differently watching it, I guess, for a second time?
I made expletive noises because when I first saw it, that was the moment. And remember, I've been saying all along that I had moments when I would forget how unearthly the protomolecule was and go back into this comfortable place of the expanse is more or less ruled by the laws of normal physics. And this is the story about stuff that's happening within the solar system. And then Eros moved. Asteroids don't just move. You know, that is physically impossible. And that means that some Star Trek stuff is happening here. And the whole show pivots on this moment.
Even Star Trek doesn't go that far.
I definitely remember the first time watching this. With my housemate, and I remember him just like yelling, like, what? Like, and yeah, it just, that moment just feels like you need to watch the next episode immediately because it just seems like something has shifted.
I didn't do.
So. Yeah, I had to stop myself, but I wanted to.
It packs kind of like a double punch in the sense that, like, what it means on a deeper level in terms of what the proto-molecule is or could be. But also, you know, you've maybe resigned to losing this character who's been on the show since the beginning and having Miller get this, like, last-minute reprieve. You know, this is something I think that's less maybe affecting the second time watching it, knowing that Miller does survive past this. But, yeah, it's pretty cool, like, working on multiple levels moment. And to actually have that, like, seeing it through Miller's eyes as someone who's, like, maybe accepted his fate and is also just individual against this massive ship. Yeah, it's so effective as a moment. There are a lot, in these two episodes, we touched briefly on the fact that there are two great cliffhangers on these episodes. And I was curious if you have favorite cliffhangers from the show, either so far or that you can remember moving forward, because it is something that I think sometimes The Expanse goes for and really pulls off and is maybe getting better at. And it wasn't necessarily something I was expecting going into this rewatch. I hadn't remembered that aspect of it. I think because I binge watched it before.
I think my favorite cliffhanger is where Bobby's stuck outside. Is it Chris Jen's ship or not? That yacht. It's Mao's yacht, and she's like climbing up the thing, and it's just going thrown back again and again.
I'm a big fan of the season two finale cliffhanger with the slow motion discorporation or whatever of, you know, Adam Savage's ship.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Poor Adam Savage. I was a big fan of Mythbusters.
Jen, do you have any favorite cliffhangers?
I think I binge watched so many of these that I don't remember what they, like, where. There's a lot of moments that I'm like, was it a cliffhanger? I think it could have been, but then it also could have been, like, a moment in the middle of the episode.
Yeah.
Like, I definitely remember that whole part. I really love those Agatha King episodes when they get to the point of the showdown between, like, these military leaders all kind of shooting each other. Are they going to send the hybrids? I think maybe this was one that ends with them shooting the hybrids at the planet. I remember that being like, oh, what is going to happen now? Like, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm the same way. Well, because we watched it the first time together. There's, like, no cliffhangers in a binge watch in some ways. But also I think that says something about the structure of the story in these episodes, that the fact that there are so many, like, cliffhanger-like moments within the episodes themselves as well, or there's just so many moments of escalating tension and stakes. That's something the show does really well, that... Yeah, they could be cliffhangers. They could be, you know, the end of the teaser. They could be the middle of the episode. There's always so much going on and things so artfully done that, yeah, it just keeps you watching scene to scene, episode to episode. Well, thank you so much for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss episodes 5 and 6 of season 2. Home and Paradigm Shift. Guys, I don't have a quote.